You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 94 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are joined again this week by Ez Third Pelton Brother, back by popular demand, the famous cousin Katie.
I'm back.
Katie. Wait. The voice of the people. The demanded third Pelton brother. The recommended permanent third co-host, famous cousin Katie.
I have way too many demands on my time to be the third Pelton brother.
Oh man.
Wow.
Wow. Could have fooled me. This is a big week. In addition to Katie, we will be welcoming in later in the show, Zach Whitman, is third/fourth Pelton brother, to help us decide the marquee matchup in our dumpling bracket, Din Tai Fung versus Dozone. We're going to get to that in a minute. But first up here, what are we drinking tonight?
Oh, we have a special drink.
That doesn't look like beer.
Great interplay here. We have a special drink here today. This is homebrewed by, I was almost going to say my former coworker. We're actually still going to be coworkers. By my coworker, a podcast agent to the stars, Josh Lindgren, brewed on his family farm in Harstein Island.
Do you brew this?
Aged? Whatever you do with cider.
Distill?
I don't know how the process works. I'm going to go with brewed. I think you're wrong for questioning that.
You got to look this up.
At his family farm on Harstein Island from Harstein Island Cider Company, we have the 2017 batch rhubarb. And I thought that this would be the perfect day to drink this because it can never be gotten again. Harstein Island Cider Company is going away for good.
Oh, no.
Because Josh is moving to Minneapolis.
All right, well, we should drink once you can get this open. A toast to Josh's new start in Minneapolis and pour some out for the demise of Harstein Island Cider Company.
Woo! I think I was told that the cider pops like champagne, and there it actually does.
Man, I am so excited to
drink
this now.
I wanted you to do that because I thought it would be much more hilarious.
I like that you're just looking at this as it continues to spill onto your table.
What am I supposed to do?
Wipe it up?
Oh, God.
Hold it? Not continue to just podcast? All right, we've paused so that Tristan could actually clean up the table and not just continue to have cider spilling on it. And now perhaps we'll be able to
pour it. It has gone everywhere. So Josh and his fiancée, Natalie, another former coworker of mine. She's an actual former coworker. Josh is still going to be my coworker and just live in Minneapolis. Have been brewing cider for 2 years, aging it, supposedly.
No, they have definitely been distilling cider. Definitely distilling, not
brewing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did you actually look that up?
You're damn right I did.
Oh, God.
It was an opportunity for me to be smug, and I have never once passed one of those up.
Isn't everything these days?
You really needed another opportunity to be smug. But speaking of smug, another thing about the cider is that you can't get it anywhere.
Oh, wow.
Very exclusive.
One of one.
And well, hopefully in Minneapolis, they start up a Twin Cities cider company and continue making the cider. And I'm curious to try it. My favorite joke about Josh moving to Minneapolis, of which there are many, mostly about how cold it is there, is that in Minneapolis, are you aware of this, that they don't play Duck Duck Goose?
I think I've heard this.
Yeah. So I learned about this when the Vikings had a celebration after one of their touchdowns.
A Duck Duck Grey Duck celebration.
Yes. Yeah.
This is like my favorite thing about the state of Minnesota. And so my favorite joke is that people in Minnesota are unaware of what the word goose is. So every single time that the word goose would appear, it's Grey Duck again.
So they wear Canada Grey Duck jackets?
I guess. What's a Canada Goose jacket?
That's like, are you serious?
The trendiest jacket
for winter.
Man, I thought you were the hipster in this group.
I don't live in a place like Minnesota. I don't need a winter jacket.
As opposed to us who live in Minnesota, apparently.
Both of you. It was more that they like to eat their favorite vodkas, Grey Duck.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one.
How many of these have you worked on?
A lot.
Okay.
Their favorite brewing company in Chicago is Grey Duck Island.
Okay.
What's good for the gray duck is good for the gander.
That's good. That's, yeah. Do they listen when they're doing nursery rhymes? It's Mother Grey Duck. Somehow that's the weirdest one of them.
Declining to participate in this.
As usual.
We're already off to a flying start.
How does this taste, by the way? Josh said it was supposed to be champagne-y.
It does, yeah.
That's why it exploded with flavor. It's good.
It's very dry. Yeah. But the rhubarb is not strong, I wouldn't say.
I told him basically to give me the driest possible cider.
Oh, thanks.
Because I knew you'd like it.
Yeah, you could tell that was my favorite. All right, should we move along and get talking about dumplings?
Can't wait.
We now welcome in as third, or in this case, actually, I guess fourth Pelton brother, just because of the logistics, one of the most popular third Pelton brothers. I think the person who originated the term, even.
Wow.
When he came on to discuss the NFL draft.
The first ever third Pelton brother.
One of his other areas of expertise. But one of his foremost areas of expertise is dumplings. And that's why we are so excited to welcome in Zach Whitman to the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, am I actually the first third Pelton brother?
I think that's the conclusion, because I remember discussing it after you came on and people, and I think you made a joking reference to it or something like that. We'll have to go through the archives.
Except for the one we don't talk about.
Wait, is the one we don't talk about the one after the championship game where you guys are running around behind CenturyLink?
Yeah. Was that the run recorded in the car?
I mean, you weren't the first guest to ever come on the Pelton cast. There were previously guests, a number of them in the first incarnation of the Pelton cast. And then, of course, you know, we had on Nate Duncan. But no one had used the term third Pelton brother.
They were much drunker in the original incarnation of the Pelton cast.
That is certainly true. All right, well, let's start with your dumpling credentials here, which I think are vastly superior to ours.
Oh, that, you know, that's a value judgment. Dumplings are what you make of them. It's the joy inside you. And I really enjoy dumplings. So I will say this whole dumpling bracket has been quite a thing for my wife and I. She is first generation Chinese from northern China. And so she has been a strong participant in family discussions, talking about what your guys' takes are and how wrong they are. So we have sampled most of the dumplings around the city. I also was in China last year and had a ton of different dumplings in a lot of different places. I do feel like I've achieved, you know, not even moderate dumpling status, but I would say I'm like a beginning dumpling enthusiast. And I certainly have the bravado and the takes to cover for what is actually not a forensic knowledge of dumplings, but I really enjoy dumpling. Although I'm not like Tristan, I'm not going to tell you that there is no bad dumpling, because there are bad dumplings.
But Zach, I want to hear what your wife's takes on our takes are.
I don't know if that's safe to air.
Wow.
I would say that her in general, I don't think Kevin offended her as much. It was more Tristan specific.
That's pretty generally true in almost any circumstance. I'm less likely to offend people than Tristan is.
I mean, I would say in general, there was a recurring theme. It, certainly early on, about the soup dumpling being the dominant dumpling. And I think that is perhaps that is born about because you live in Seattle and there are really good soup dumplings around. But I'm not sure that that's something, like if you grew up in the 90s in Seattle, you'd think that Oregon State point guards are pretty great. I'm not sure that necessarily soup dumplings are quite as dominant maybe as we're portrayed on the podcast. And that was a source of some consternation.
That's hard for me to imagine that there could be regular dumplings out there better than soup dumplings. It's like almost inconceivable to me. I would love to try them, I guess.
I mean, it's a different experience. We can get into the etymology of the soup dumplings, but I think that the thing we experience certainly locally is a very specific kind of thing that I think is perhaps in various places, certainly the experiences I had in China was less specifically something we had, I guess, and it was much more boiled dumplings, steamed dumplings, less of an emphasis on the soup dumplings.
Yeah, that makes sense. I can certainly buy that. We're here to talk about the two finalists in the soup dumpling region of the bracket. The number one seed, Din Tai Fung. I think for most people in the Seattle area, the first time they've like truly had dumplings is like what they were going to have, as opposed to maybe something that they have, you know, you have as part of a meal at dim sum, is going to be Din Tai Fung.
Gateway dumpling.
Gateway dumplings, if we've gone over in the past, versus the rising challenger, the up and comer, Dozone. The three of us all went to both of these locations today that are recorded here, the famous Cousin Katie, Tristan and I. Zach, you went to both of them over the weekend?
Yeah, I actually had a big event on Thursday night where we ordered an ungodly amount of Din Tai Fung. And then we went there with my wife on Sunday morning. We were actually first in line, which is especially kind of embarrassing. We were first in line at Dozone at like 10:50 a.m. So we got the first there, and that was a great experience as well.
What else besides that did you get at Din Tai Fung?
So we had a massive order. We had almost every kind of dumpling, going from like kimchi dumplings to shaomai to both kinds of the major soup dumplings there, the snow crab and the pork. We had a few of my other favorites at Din Tai Fung, which I love the Shanghai rice cakes there. Incredible. Always good. It's always great too, because if you struggle with chopsticks, they're most impossible to eat, and that kind of adds a fun party game to the mix. Because there's always one person who's trying to scrape the sticky rice cakes off the bottom. But yeah, no, we had a really good big order. It's great to go to Din Tai Fung with the big group, right? Because you get to taste everything. You're not limited to a few things. And Din Tai Fung, we'll get into this, but they certainly have a lot of variety, and they make a lot of things very well.
Right. That's, I think, a good description of them. Yeah, Katie and I were lamenting this over lunch that we want to go with a group of approximately 8 people so that we can share more things. As it was just the two of us, and we had, of course, the pork xiaolongbao soup dumplings. We had the pork bao, yeah. And then also got pork and shrimp xiaomai.
The xiaomai is really an underrated thing there. That is one of my favorite Din Tai Fung cuisine.
I think that was the first time I've had it. I can't remember having it. Certainly after I had it, it didn't remind me of anything I've had. Although I always look at it and it always looks good on the menu. So I'm glad I actually tried it.
I went with the pork xiaolongbao and then a pork steam dumplings, because I was doing them all literally on my plate. I had Dozone and Din Tai Fung on the exact same plate together against each other.
Wow, were they the equal temperature?
Yes.
Wow.
They were all competing on a level playing field.
Intriguing. All right, so let's turn our attention now to Dozone. Tristan already mentioned, I suppose you got the same thing at Dozone as you got at Din Tai Fung?
Similar. I got the Qiu Bao, basically their pork buns, and then a pork xiaolongbao there.
Which is what I also got. Katie?
We got those two things, and then we got the cucumber, sliced cucumber. It's a very fancy cucumber, but not a dumpling at all, but it's good.
Yeah, that's not going to – I'm going to eliminate that from the rankings entirely.
But it's a good cucumber.
It's something that we had. I don't know.
Good
and
cucumber.
Then we got the spicy – some sort of spicy wonton thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
Boiled – I don't know.
Yeah, which we've had before at both locations. Yeah. Good cucumber, no such thing.
Oh, God damn it.
Have you tried the one there?
No.
Both locations have such good cucumbers.
Nope. It's inedible.
I've had the Dozone cucumber and was quite underwhelmed.
Oh, wow. The takes are already getting hot. Oh. All right, Zach, what did you have this time at Dozone?
So I went with what I think is the right order at Dozone. I feel like we've taken, you know, some time to get it right. And with only 2 people, you have to be somewhat careful with what you go with. You know, you can't obviously, you'd like to go with 8 people. But I believe the right order is to get a soup dumpling. We got the pork. We got the Qiu Bao, which is the best thing on the menu probably at Dozone and possibly much wider as far as restaurants go. And then some boiled dumplings, I think the pork and shrimp and the green onion pancake.
How is the green onion pancake? Because I almost ordered that, partially because it's cheap and it looked really good in your pictures.
I don't know if you've had green onion pancake before, scallion pancake. It's a really common food among Chinese cuisine. And there's kind of 2 different kinds. There's kind of the thicker, cakier kind that can be made flakier, like you'd see at Rocking Wok, or more of a cakey version. And then there's kind of the thinner, oilier version at Dozone. I generally prefer kind of the thicker, cakier version. you're ever in the Bay Area, there's a wonderful place called Wonderful that makes an amazing green onion pancake, probably the best I've ever had. But as far as the oily, thinner versions go, this was quite good. And it was like $3 and you get the 8 slices. So if you, I mean, as far as a dumpling restaurant goes, it's a pretty good bargain.
Okay, so Zach, we couldn't imagine having anybody else be the third Pelton brother, except for the other two people we invited on for this. Anybody else being the third Pelton brother for this crucial matchup. Do you think, when you're looking at the bracket, do you feel like these are the top two dumpling places? You, as a more of a dumpling expert than any of us, do we have the bracket right? Are we at the right place right now?
I mean, I would like to, again, just... I'm not an expert, to really make sure that's clear. And I've only had certain kinds of dumplings. I mean, the thing you learn, like, there's just a million different kinds. And if you're in Taiwan versus, you know, mainland China, or there's going to be a lot different. So my experience, like anyone, is pretty limited. But I think there are three places I really like in the Seattle area. There's Din Tai Fung and Dozo, which do have the best soup dumplings. If we were not in the soup dumpling bracket, I would submit that Mama's Dough in Kent, which you guys also looked at and I believe lost to Dough's on the first round. In terms of fried and boiled dumplings, I think they make probably the thing most closely resembling what I've had in China. And I think that their actual fried boiled dumplings are better than those at Dough's on Din Tai Fung, although the soup dumplings there are not the star of the show and not why you go.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. I think they were the best fried dumplings we've had, the ones at Mama Does. So you didn't have those, right,
no.
Tristan? Yeah, I mean, we're going to need to get back there and review that more times to try more of the menu. Sadly, it just came up against Dozone in the first round, and that was not a matchup it had any chance of winning. But that still leaves us, I guess, as Tristan was saying, in the right place. Do we want to compare specifically on different types of dumplings or just do an overall pick here? What do we think?
I think we go overall pick. I'm curious Zach's thoughts generally on each of his experiences, though.
Yeah, so I guess I would say here is that one question I had for you. So Dozone, I believe their signature dish is the Qbao, mm-hmm. which is the pork fried buns. What are we calling a soup dumpling, though? Because you'll notice Xiaolongbao, the last word is bao.
Right.
Because I believe literally it's a soup-filled bun. And so I know, like, and I asked my wife trying to kind of clarify. I think they have bigger ones that are soup dumpling-esque in China. So it's not always the Din Tai Fung, like, size that they're made into.
Interesting.
They resemble very much like a boiled dumpling, how we've had them here. But I would submit that it would not be out of bounds to consider Qbao if we're doing a strict soup dumpling evaluation as well, just because they are, you know, kind of a cousin there. Not a famous cousin, Katie, but nonetheless, some kind of cousin relationship.
100% agree here. I think we have to include it.
Yep. I mean, it would be a disservice to these restaurants to not include the best item at the restaurant.
Well, I mean, I don't think we want to go completely out of bounds and consider, for example, you know, you had the hand-shaved noodle in soup at the Mama's Dough. And that's obviously not a dumpling, but the Qbao is, I think the cousin is a good way to put it. So yes, we're incorporating that in our conclusion.
Excellent.
Okay, so that being the case, what do you think?
So what are we just kind of detailing our kind of experience at different restaurants, or are we, how do we want to go about this? I guess this is very important. I don't want to jump in the wrong way.
Detail your experience is a way of taking us to your winner.
So, I mean, I've had Din Tai Fung. I, as a Seattle resident, certainly it's something. Din Tai Fung is a great place, especially if you're taking people who haven't had dumplings before, like you were talking about. And so you can kind of take anybody as an entry point there. This specific time, we had a group of 9, which was great. And it's awesome because you're getting like 3 wontons. You know, you're getting 4 pork soup dumplings. You're getting 3 or 4 crab, shaomai, the kimchi dumplings. You get enough where you're having 1 or 2 of different dishes, getting to kind of sample. And I think that is the best experience. So to some extent, I had to pull myself back emotionally from that. The free-flowing experience where you're getting to taste everything and compare it to a Dozone experience with 2 people. So that is a difference there. But I would say the Shanghai rice cakes are phenomenal. They're not part of this evaluation. They do provide a good in-between dumpling medium, I guess. I think I would rate the pork soup dumplings there 8.5 out of 10. The boiled dumplings there, I probably give a 7.5 to an 8 out of 10. very close behind. And in general, I had a delightful dining experience. And if I was trying again, if I was trying to take somebody who had not experienced dumplings, wanted an easy entree point with lots of different foods, lots of different things they could try, I think I would take them to Din Tai Fung because it is a really easy, immersive experience that doesn't quite have the learning curve maybe of other restaurants.
I'm with you so far.
In general, it was a good Din Tai Fung experience. I don't think I can tell a lot of difference in the different branches. Do you want me to give an overall grade here or what? I don't know what we want to give away too early as far as votes.
If you feel comfortable giving an overall grade, that's certainly fine, but not required.
I would say we can get into it and actually cast my vote, but I really enjoy going to Din Tai Fung, and I wish they hadn't raised their prices 20% because that is
right.
Brutal. $15 for the crab soup dumpling, no joke.
Right. All right, Dozone.
So Dozone, again, we were there at 10:50 on a Sunday morning, bright and early. It really made me feel kind of at one. And by the way, I will say there was a line of probably 30 people at 11 in the morning when it actually opened, which blew me away.
That's almost Portland Brunch-esque.
It was interesting. I will say, so I've been to a few different locations of Dozone. Where did you guys go for your experience today?
I think all over the map. I was International District. I was in Crossroads in Bellevue.
Issaquah.
Wow. So I think that I've had them at two or three Dozones. I think the Crossroads I've had the best experience with in general. We went there on Sunday. I think the soup dumplings there, I really do think they are phenomenal. It's like a 9.5 out of 10.
Nice.
I think that the actual skin of the soup dumpling at Din Tai Fung is thinner, but sometimes you lose one, and so there's a little bit of spillage there. Mm-hmm. So maybe you get 20 soup dumplings, but you're losing one and a half soup dumplings just because somebody grabs it and it spills out. And that's just not a great experience, right? I mean, you're losing 10%, 15% of your food. Not a huge fan of that. I do like the thickness of the Dozone, and the flavor is also phenomenal. Really the right temperature when it comes out. You didn't have to wait at all. You could go right in. That was a great experience. The boiled dumpling was good. It does not reach to the heights of the soup dumpling at Dozone. Their peak thing really is the soup dumpling. But the boiled dumpling was also good. It had a heavy chive influence, which my wife likes a lot. I know that what I tasted in China, in Beijing, was much more. There were more vegetable dumplings and kind of more of a heavy chive or veggie influence. And so those I thought were also quite good. And the Qubao is just the star of the show. I mean, it is so phenomenal. Also a 9.5 out of 10. The only issue there is you have to be kind of skillful to eat it well, just because you bite into it and it's about a 4-bite to 5-bite procedure, depending on how kind of gross you want to look while you're eating it. But then you're also trying to do it with the chopsticks. And so it's a tough thing to bite in. Not splash the juice back, but also kind of get into that meat core, right? So it does take a little bit of strategy and maybe one or two times before you really get the rhythm of how to eat it. But overall, I will say I went into that experience thinking that I was going to pick Din Tai Fung. And after eating, I had to think about it and really discuss what the take was, because I had forgotten just how good those few top items at Dozone were.
Man, I mean, that was a thorough breakdown. I feel like I agree with every single bit of it, right?
Yeah. No, I do.
Honestly, when I was looking at these, especially the soup dumplings on my plate, I had the steamed dumplings from Din Tai Fung, and they were very good, right? I had the steamed pork dumplings. They had like the perfect amount of mushiness on the inside, right? It was like soft and flavorful. I liked everything about it. The soup dumplings, honestly, when they're on the plate, if I would have done a blind taste test between the two, I would not have been able to tell the difference, especially given all the sauces that you have on there, you know, the spicy sauce.
You're just sauce plain, on soup dumplings.
Just layers and layers of cucumbers on my plate.
That's all you need is the taste of the soup dumplings.
Can we ask the expert about this?
Again, not an expert.
Oh,
but
sorry.
Zach, what is your take?
Not an expert, but I would not be. It is moderately offensive to me, at least, that we're dumping the soup dumplings in some kind of sauce because they already kind of have all the flavors there.
Every time.
Exactly.
I need some spiciness.
Your mileage may vary.
So diplomatically put, Zach. I would say that my take on the soup dumplings was, so we went to Din Tai Fung first, and I was like, man, these are better than I remember. Yeah. These are just as good as Dozon. And then I went to Dozon, and it was like, these are still better than Din Tai Fung.
I had that exact same thought. So,
and then there's the Cubao. How did they manage to get it, like, the perfect, like, crispiness on the outside and yet still so, like, tender on the inside?
Yes.
It's incredible. It boggles the mind how they can pull this off.
I was just going to say my daughter went with us and she actually tried the Cubao this time and she kept saying, oh, it's so good. It's so flavorful. It just has so much flavor. And she just kept saying flavor. And I was like, yeah, that's pretty accurate description of it for a five-year-old. So it's just really delicious.
Should have had her on. She should have been the deciding vote.
Well, we may still have a tie.
Well, you're going to need to go wake her up right now.
I mean, I feel like if you had a bracket of Seattle's best, like, entrees or something, I would rank the Cubao very highly. Just not even restricting it to a dumpling. We're going against Loretta's Burger. I don't care what the different thing. Like, it'd be hard to convince me there's much better than the pork bun at Dozon.
This is a take I can endorse because one thought I had while I was sitting there eating by myself at Dozon as quickly as possible so that I could get back to my car, which I had parked in half-hour parking, was... And I'm going to move ahead now to the vote. Not only is Dozon my pick in this bracket, Dozon might be my favorite restaurant in Seattle.
Wow.
Wow.
I love the idea of a bracket where we're comparing all foods also.
Wow.
Maybe once we've been through all of our various brackets and,
bracket.
And searches, then we do the super bracket.
Oh, it's like a tournament of champions.
Oh, that's exciting.
We're going to be the winners of that also. But again, I mean, I had these two soup dumplings. I'm like, I really like both of these soup dumplings. But the Cubao, there's just nothing like it on the Din Tai Fung menu. And there's so many different things. We talked about Dim Sum Factory. Dim Sum Factory does tons of different stuff and none of it that well. Din Tai Fung does so many different things at such a high level, but does not have, as far as my experience, a single item that reaches the heights of that Cubao. And I think Dozon is competitive enough in every other place that I had to pick it. Zach.
Wow. Okay, so I feel like we all had the same experience because really coming here from Din Tai Fung, I really thought I was going to win. I went in thinking Dozon because I had had Dozon most recently. And maybe this is a thing where it's just the thing I have most recently I would hope for because it is really good food. But I went in after the Din Tai Fung experience thinking, you know, that's probably going to be it. The variety, they do so many things so well. And I still say if I was taking somebody who hadn't experienced dumplings anywhere, it would be to Din Tai Fung. But after eating at Dozon, after dipping my toes in that pool and taking my first bite of the Cubao and popping a soup dumpling in, that is Seattle's best dumpling. And I don't think it's actually that. I think it's like a 10 or 15% bump. Just the soup dumpling. And then you bring in the Cubao, which is probably the best entrant in the genre at all. And it really has to be Dozon. And Dozon may be, you know, it may be limited. It may not have all the bells and whistles. It may not have all the variety. It may not have everything that Din Tai Fung has to offer. But the things it does make, it makes at a level that does surpass Din Tai Fung.
Kitty, you going to make this clean sweep?
Is this a sweep?
I'm going to add some drama.
Oh!
Had kind of a non-food related issue at the Dozon today. Okay. We went to the Issaquah one. And it was freezing cold in there.
Oh, no.
So cold that we had to, like, share my coat as a blanket. And I managed to...
You're torturing your child for this dumpling bracket. You're like, we have to eat these for the Peltcast dumpling bracket, damn it.
I managed to burn my tongue drinking the hot tea as kind of like a remedy for the coldness of the restaurant.
No.
Well, Ben B would tell you that on average, the temperature is evened out.
Okay. Even still, I don't understand.
Zach, I know you know where I'm coming from, given what you were posting over the weekend.
I'm loving it.
All right. Let's move on, I guess.
What I'm saying is even with that experience, the Cubao was so good that I had to go with Dozon.
And indeed, it is a clean sweep. A fitting tribute. I mean, Din Tai Fung came in here as the number one seed. I don't know if it was necessarily the favorite, but it was, it's, you know, the establishment choice. And I think we have conclusively determined with this extensive sample of people that Dozone is now Seattle's best dumpling.
Wow.
Seattle's best soup dumplings. I guess we still have to.
We still technically have another round.
We do.
I feel lightheaded.
Well, I'm really glad that we could make you a part of the sack. No one has taken more interest in our dumpling bracket other than Mike, who has gone to like six different restaurants at this point. If he ever makes it to Dozone, Godspeed getting there. But again, no one else we would have rather have be a part of it. And where can people check out your dumpling and also possibly football-related takes?
Mostly dumplings at my Twitter at ZJ Whitman. I will be ramping up at some point here NFL draft coverage, kind of more toward the combine goes at 3sigmaathlete.com. But that is mostly on hold right now as we kind of wait for the first test. But you rest assured that if you want to talk dumplings, you can at me on Twitter and we will have a lively debate. I'm sure I'll have some at my mentions, some people correcting me on some dumpling takes, and I'm here for it.
Pretty soon we're going to start talking about ramen versus pho, because you're on the right side of that debate also.
Ramen's better, yeah.
Yeah, it's a 3-1 vote at this amongst this current group right now. We will be sure to have you back on, Zach, as we get near the draft and start preparing for that. But again, thanks for joining us.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Wow.
Oh, man. A clean sweep.
I'm not surprised, and yet I'm still surprised.
I mean, this was like the Sonics in 96 over the Jazz in the second round.
Or the Rockets.
Over the Rockets,
yeah,
in the second
two-time
round.
Yeah, the two-time defending champion Rockets. Yeah, that's a great analogy there. Well done.
Is it? Really good one.
For our Seattle Sports and Dumplings podcast.
Do you want to know that today, I was telling you about my plate where I had both different kinds of soup dumplings and steamed dumplings on the plate, plus the Cubao that I also earlier today, because I'm competing that hard, had a Pike Place Market humbao.
Whoa.
Wow.
Wait, what even is that? Can you tell
you
us more?
You don't know about the Pike Place humbao?
I do not know about this.
Neither of you know about this?
No.
I mean, it's the best humbao in the entire world.
Voted by whom?
By me.
Did we do a bracket?
Me and Josh voted on it today. Okay. It was his last day. Look, he does. It's very cold where he's going. Give him this.
Make it sound like he's dying.
It's a humbao, like basically a pork bun, but it's a little bit crispy on the outside and so soft on the inside.
Yeah, that sounds exactly
so
like
the
cubao.
Yeah.
Except cubao has like a meatball inside. Uh-huh. This is more like a
shredded pork.
Like a shredded pork.
Okay. Yeah,
ooh,
no, I'm into that. I'm into
right
that.
Up my
I like
alley.
What you're talking about.
And they have all sorts of different kinds. Even, I'm going to say this. I know this sounds disgusting. They have a ham and corn one, and it kind of looks good.
I mean, that's basically you're eating the world's best Hot Pocket at that point, right?
Yes.
Is that a Hot Pocket? Ham and corn?
Ham and cheese is the Hot Pocket.
I don't know that I've had the ham and corn.
If it was a ham and cheese humbao, I would 100% get it.
Yes. I'm the resident garbage palate person here, and I don't know about that. Okay. Ham and corn.
That's fair.
Josh also got the crab rangoon, which he gave an excellent rating.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, well, we'll have to give this a try.
I can't believe you don't know about these. These are like the most famous humbaos.
No. You know, I knew very little about like Pike Place Chowder Company until I went there. Like, I was completely blissfully unaware of it.
Wow. I bet Macklemore knows a lot about these humbaos.
I bet he does.
He cares about Seattle, unlike you.
Everything in Pike's Place was kind of like a tourist trap.
Not everything is. There's good stuff there.
There's definitely good stuff there.
I mean, I like the little donuts, but that's...
There's
supposedly some good burritos.
There's beachers in Pike Place. You consider that a tourist trap? Rachel's ginger beer?
I'm not going to wait in line for like 2 hours to have beachers.
You don't
I'm sorry.
Need to wait in line. I walked up, not a single person there for the humbao.
Or you
I
can just
waltzed right in.
Just get a flight. Just go to SeaTac Airport.
Or Bellevue.
You know what, by the way? You
how
know where
many
they
tourists
have,
do you think there are in February? Yeah.
Well, that's fair.
It was a nice day.
You know where they have beachers mac and cheese?
Where?
At Alaska Airlines Arena.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't know that. They actually have like good vendors there now?
They have Beecher's mac and cheese.
Okay. Beecher's mac and cheese.
That's where we'll stop.
Yeah.
Well, we'll find out on Thursday when we're there for not Isaiah Thomas's jersey retirement.
We'll get into that in a second. We have more food to discuss. All right. You went all these different places. Did you go to Little Woody's this week?
Absolutely, I did. I mean, I'm getting that apron.
Week two of Seattle Burger Month. What's the review? What was the burger and what's the review? Because both you and, well, no, I guess you didn't have it, Katie. But you went to Lil Woody's.
I went in support of my husband.
Yeah, he had it, right?
Yes, yes. Okay. I have to support his New Year's resolution, which was to to get the burger apron.
That was his resolution.
That's a good resolution.
So much better than eating healthy.
You have to dream big.
Working out, eating healthy. Getting the burger apron. All right.
Can I just say, we're not even on, but I just want to say you were 100% correct. Ube shake is the best shake you can have at Lil Woody's.
Ube shake.
We're still recording, right?
And only
people heard that.
Only available in Ballard.
In Ballard,
right,
which is a travesty because we went to the West Seattle one, and or White Center.
White Center one, yeah.
And they only had the regular flavors.
Right, right,
and
yeah.
And the chocolate malt was not that good, which is what I had in between two meals of dumplings. It's like, I'm gonna pace myself and have a chocolate malt.
So I think, wait, what if I told you about telling Kevin that he's right about things?
That's a fair point.
Okay.
I think the ube is only available in Ballard because of the fact that it's near the Hood Famous Bake Shop and their ube specialty, which I have not ever.
You haven't had the cheesecake, have
you?
I want
to
have
there.
That. So
that's also on our list. Seattle's best cheesecake.
I thought it was because of the proximity to Full Tilt.
Full Tilt's right there in White Center as well. The Bake Shop, it's like right down the road from it.
Do they use Full Tilt ice cream, though?
They do.
Yeah, but the ube, I think, is just specifically a Hood Famous Bake Shop thing.
They have ube at Full Tilt.
Oh, do they?
All the Full Tilts?
Oh, then I guess I rescind what I said.
Forever.
Then it makes no sense.
All right, well,
this is Full Tilt related.
We need, again, I think I mentioned it when we added Lil Woody's earlier when we were trying to get the Beecher's Mac and Cheeseburger on the menu full time. I also added them to mention, hey, let's get the ube shake everywhere.
You're not doing as much as Evan, who's got the petition for In-N-Out Burger. He wants to bring it to Washington. So you need to get a full petition going.
Need to start a petition?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You need to work on that.
I've been thinking that we need like a Pelton Cast goal.
Yeah, that's
and
a good
that's
goal.
A good one to have.
Is to get. I've never even had an ube shake.
It's
I
really
can get
good.
Behind this, though.
I didn't think it was going to be good. It was good.
The goal is to have an ube shake at all Lil Woody's locations.
Yeah.
I think we can make this happen.
it's much more
attainable than bringing In-N-Out to Washington.
Or like bringing the Sonics back. That's too big
I've
for us.
I've given up on that. So this ranks Burger Month Burger from Chef Shota Nakajima from Adana. Shota's burger was the Osaka burger, which was Painted Hills grass-fed beef, miso aioli, karashi aioli, caramelized onions, shredded cabbage, a kalbi chip on the bottom, kind of a spicy kalbi chip on the bottom, seaweed sprinkled on top of a sunny side egg.
So that's a lot going on. How did it come together?
It was pretty good. The chip kind of got lost. They put the chip on the bottom of the burger, which here's my hot take. Unless this is actually a very cold take, unless it's kind of like trading James Harden instead of Dwight Howard, anything that goes below the burger patty is gonna get kind of lost in the mix, unless everything is below the burger patty.
Okay, I can buy that.
Wait.
So you either commit to the burger patty on top with all of the condiments below it, or you don't put anything below it. Because the chip was kind of just like there. It kind of got smushed into the burger patty almost.
You're saying that you need the burger patty to be next to one bun or the other.
Yes. You can have a sauce or whatever in between.
But chips, you need the crunch to be near the top?
The crunch should be on the top.
Okay, yeah.
It kind of got soggy on the bottom.
I can see that.
But I'm always into the sunny side up egg. And again, I would have it almost served as the cheese on this. It added some moisture to each bite. But I wanted more. I could have used two sunny side eggs.
What were your thoughts on the cabbage? I know that Chris Smith had some thoughts
on the cabbage.
At
all.
Oh, okay.
Honestly, the cabbage didn't bother me. It didn't stand out. All I really tasted was egg and patty and kind of the sauce I thought was really good.
What was Ben's review of this?
I think he liked the first burger better.
Okay.
I think he said, I don't want to go too negative.
We'll have a full ranking of these four burgers at the end of Seattle Burger.
If you go too negative, we'll never get that ube shake.
Yeah, I know. I don't want to go too negative. I want that ube shake.
Completely fair. One other food-related item we need to discuss this week. You went someplace for the first time in, I believe, a decade?
Do you remember when we went there?
No.
What year do you think that was?
I have no idea.
So we went to the Other Coast Cafe. I think I was working at the Seattle Storm at the time.
Okay.
And
that puts it approximately 2009?
I was young and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And
before you got unceremoniously let go by the storm.
After that, I turned dark. Once I was fired by the storm, then things got much more serious. I was not used to the, like, $10 sandwich lunch. Now I don't bat an eyelash at it.
Right. Of course.
I mean, if I see a $10 sandwich, I'm like, whatever, who cares? If a lunch item is less than $15, I will not even think about it.
So we went that time to the location in Ballard.
Yes.
There is also in Other Coast in Capitol Hill, which is directly next to
Honey Hole.
And you always would go to Honey Hole and never.
You have to walk by Honey Hole to get to the Other Coast.
Right. But I would do that.
Depending
when
on which direction.
When I have eaten sandwiches in Capitol.
Every direction you have to go by Honey Hole.
Yeah, it's all roads lead
to Honey circles
Hole.
At 360.
It's like a Starbucks. I have been to the Honey Hole once, but multiple times have been to the Capitol Hill Other Coast Cafe location because it is my take, my longstanding take, for over 10 years, that the Raging Cajun sandwich at the Other Coast Cafe is Seattle's best sandwich, a bracket we are going to have to do at some time down the road.
Are you comparing this to Un Bien and Paseo?
Yes.
I am. God. Yes.
Oh. Fuck Paseo.
No.
You guys are the worst.
I just really hate Paseo. I'm sorry. I don't really hate Paseo.
And you hate Un Bien as well?
You're going to start offending people again with your takes.
Un Bien is basically the same. It's no different. Onions are way too big. Nobody wants onions
that's
that
a fair
big.
Take.
No, I want onions that big. Onions are delicious, especially the fried onions, like the sautéed onions. Sorry, sautéed onions are delicious.
I want to throw those onions into Lake Washington.
You want the smaller, crispier onions that they have on the Raging Cajun.
Oh, the Raging Cajun's so good.
This is another thing where I'm just like...
Voice of the people?
Feeding into Kevin's hands.
Oh.
The first time he took me to the Other Coast... I went against his advice and got like a turkey sandwich.
What? When you didn't get there's like signs on the wall where it's like home of the Raging Cajun.
And I was like, this
is a turkey sandwich. That's a good, just a life tip. When you go in a restaurant and they specifically highlight a food item, get that food item. It's probably pretty good. Like there might be some other good stuff on the menu, but just get that at least the first time.
So anyways, it wasn't good. It was like, it wasn't bad. It was just like a sandwich.
Yeah, it was fine.
And then I went there like years later and had the Raging Cajun. I was like, I kind of see what Kevin is talking about now. So this is another in the long series of me saying.
So when we went in 2008, Al was so frustrated about
gesticulating wildly.
I haven't been hit yet, so it's an improvement.
God,
look, I'm the
it's
one
starting to feel like the Huskies are just
injured lately. Okay,
you're fine. God,
I'm not fine.
Get over it.
It's very painful, Bruce Trips.
Are you playing basketball at All Star?
No,
because they don't play basketball games. Or?
There's some people do. I've never played basketball at All Star, but I am in no condition to play basketball at this point.
Okay. Have you considered applying for the Celebrity All Star game?
Ooh,
I am like 10 levels too low for that.
Would love to see Wynn Butler posting you up.
I need for like someone to be the head coach so I can be the assistant coach like Zach Lowe was for Bill Simmons. That's like my role here.
That would be exciting too.
I mean, if Zach Lowe is involved, I feel like you're in the world. But if anybody asks you, if a basketball game comes up and anybody asks you if you want to play and you say no, and they're like, why? You have to be like, because my brother, who's 3 inches shorter than me, goes hard in the motherfucking paint. That's what you tell them. You can't handle it. You're like Zach Collins. I don't know.
Weren't we talking about what you thought about the Raging Cajun?
Yeah. It's good. It's really good.
Of course it is. That's what I've been trying to tell you for years. That's why I'm gesticulating wildly. Why don't you people ever listen to me?
It was really good. I mean, it might have been that I've had the Chachi's favorite at Honey Hole like 60 times in the last 3 years. So...
maybe just one of those times it would have made sense to go over to the Other Coast.
I mean, I think I have some Honey Hole exhaust.
It's a great sandwich. It's my favorite for when we do Seattle's Best Sandwich. And by the way, if you think the takes have been hot about dumplings, when we do sandwiches, oh my goodness.
The takes are going to be hotter.
Insufferable.
Should we talk about the NBA?
It's been a while.
It has been a while. So with the All-Star break coming up this weekend... before I head down to LA for that, we thought it might be a good time to check back in on the list of 10 players to watch I gave you at the start of the season. Mm. Have you watched any of these players?
Hold on 1 second. Let me pull up the list. No. I mean, they may have been on a game, but have I specifically watched them?
So I want to say that I am going to, in the future, watch Justin Holiday when I don't have any other UW players to root for in the NBA.
Oh, no. You're all going to be out of the NBA. Okay, we're going to get to that in a second. We're getting to that.
Maybe Isaiah will be able to get a two-way contract.
So these are often players who... these are often... sadly, he's not eligible. These are often players who are rookies or new to the NBA. Often they're...
bursting the two-way contract.
International prospects.
The glass ceiling.
But we tried to get a little less obscure this year after going maybe a little too fringe in years past. So the first player on the list is John Collins, a rookie first-round pick of the Atlanta Hawks. And Collins, he's been overshadowed by the fact that there have been so many good rookies, in particular rookies drafted late in the round. But John Collins has been excellent when he's played. He looks every bit like a guy who's going to be a fixture as a starter for many years to come, and super exciting to watch. He had this incredible alley-oop in a game I was watching a couple weeks ago where he catches the ball like it's a terribly thrown lob, and he catches the ball at this incredible angle, and it manages to make the dunk look so much more impressive because of the fact he has to cock his arms so far back to catch and dunk, and that's the kind of athleticism and explosiveness he has around the rim.
Okay. You've sold us on John Collins.
Justin Holiday was the second player in this list because it was really going to be fascinating to see him in Chicago. Is for the first couple months of the season, the go-to player, improbably, on an NBA basketball team. Someone who was like the third or fourth option most of his time at the University of Washington, thrust into this role of go-to scorer.
How did that go?
He scored a lot of points at a very poor efficiency during the first couple months of the season. He's settled in a little bit. He's shooting 38% from three, still averaging a career-high 13.4 points per game this season. It was someone whose name came up in trade talks as someone who could be more valuable to a contending team than he is in the Bulls, although he will remain with them. First month of the season, or at least in November, he averaged 14.6 points per game on 38% shooting. So that wasn't maybe the ideal role for Justin Holiday, but still fun to watch. Next on the list, Juancho Hernan Gomez. And this has been a rough year for the brothers Hernan Gomez.
Oh, no.
And their fabulous Hernan Gomez cast. Billy Hernan Gomez.
The dumpling bracket is not going well.
Billy Hernan Gomez got buried on the bench in New York, got traded last week to Charlotte. Juancho suffered mono early in the season, lost a lot of weight, and has not really been able to get his season back on track after that. So
you should have known that was coming when you put him on this list.
I'm curious, Tristan, if you did who he play for on these players after already hearing what teams they played for at the beginning of the season, what do you think you would average?
I mean, some of them, I think I know all of the rest of them.
Really?
There's one of them that I don't know, but I can do...
Okay, Jordan Bell?
Warriors.
Yeah, where Jordan Bell has been one of the revelations of the season is a second-round pick out of Oregon.
These are all just you patting yourself on the back.
Not all of them. The Warriors...
Sometimes they get mono.
They paid $3.5 million for it, or something like that. The most ever paid for a second-round draft pick. And it was money well spent, because Jordan Bell was blocking shots like crazy. He suddenly developed into one of the league's like best passing big men. He's like a new Draymond Green, basically. He hasn't played in about a month because he badly sprained his ankle and suffered some damage related to that in a game in early January. And I think that's actually part of why the Warriors have struggled defensively in the last month, is because they haven't had Jordan Bell.
They have new coaches on the Warriors. I don't know if you saw that today.
The players coached the team. It was quite exciting.
Yeah. Wait, what happened?
Like, the players got to do all the coaching in the game. They led the huddles and things like that.
Today?
Yeah. Draymond Green was just out there with the clipboard, like, drawing up plays.
And that's what happens when you're as good as the Warriors are?
Well, yes. And when you're going through the midseason malaise that they were. And then they beat the Suns by 46 points.
That's just like a trend for beating the Suns by.
Well, I saw a stat that they have as many losses by 40-plus points as the entire rest of the NBA combined. Yeah. I will be seeing the Warriors on Wednesday night when they come to Portland to wrap up the first half or the pre-All-Star part of the season. So that'll be interesting.
This is the one that I don't know.
Jochi. You need to venture a guess?
Rockets?
Rockets is correct, yes. Daryl Morey favorite, obviously. The history of Chinese players in Houston, no surprise there. Jochi, a favorite of the statistical projections, but very raw, has not played much this season. But it's been kind of exciting when he has. He's mostly been in the G League. All right, next up, Milos Teodosic.
On the Clippers.
Who has not, I would say, been quite as exciting and highlight-driven as we kind of hoped coming into the season, but just has been a really good point guard for the Clippers, who are playing solid basketball without Chris Paul and now without Blake Griffin. He's kind of established himself as the quality NBA player that people thought he could be playing in Europe, is maybe the best player in Europe for many years.
He's also established himself as the guy who eats hamburgers for breakfast.
So he denied that.
I know.
There was an excellent Mark Stein piece in the New York Times on Monday where Stein sat down for breakfast with Teodosic, and they did not have hamburgers, sadly.
Wait, what's the situation with this?
With what?
But the Teo Dosich eating hamburgers for breakfast.
Sam Decker, his Clippers teammate, claimed that he tried to order them at a McDonald's at 9 a.m. when they went through the drive-thru. And Teo Dosich said in the article that it was a joke.
Is it that crazy to eat hamburgers for breakfast, though?
I mean, they're not that different from sausage patties.
I just don't know why you would do that. But I'm not going to be like, oh, that's terribly unhealthy if they're both at the McDonald's anyway.
McDonald's. Unless you're going with the fruit and yogurt parfait, odds are it's not going to be a great meal. All right, next on the list, Thon Maker, and I would say
Milwaukee Bucks.
It's been a disappointing season for
Thon.
Yeah, he lost his starting job to John Henson, has kind of just regressed in several key areas. The Bucks brought in Tyler Zeller to maybe compete for playing time with him, so just altogether not great for Thon.
What do you make of this Bucks story that they've been really good ever since they fired Jason Kidd?
So they've had, and stop me if you've heard this before.
Oh, no.
Really great luck in terms of opponent three-point percentages after the coaching change. I mean, I think they are.
They've been trying harder on defense, you mean?
I think they are better, and they're going to do a better job of not giving up as many threes and shots at the rim. But I don't think they're quite as good as they've looked.
Okay.
All right, next on the list, Frank Ntilikina.
For the Knicks.
Yeah. Ntilikina, you know, a pretty solid start. More advanced, I'd say, as a playmaker in the pick and roll than people expected because he didn't play with the ball in his hands a lot when he was in France previously. A disruptive defender, although still some work to do at that end of the court. Now, what's kind of disappointing is now he's playing almost exclusively off the ball because the Knicks just traded for Emmanuel Mudiay at the deadline, and he's suddenly playing a lot at point guard and playing reasonably well. All right, next on the list, Jonathan Isaac.
On the Magic.
That is correct.
I didn't know that one.
You didn't think I was going to get that one, did you?
Yeah, he played reasonably well early in the year. He's missed like basically most of the last month and a half now due to a severe sprained ankle and kind of the situation with that. So similar to Jordan Bell, we haven't seen him in a while. All right, and then last on the list, a player I saw last night in Portland, Donovan Mitchell.
I'm pretty sure you just snuck him on here after. He wasn't on the original list. You saw how Donovan Mitchell was playing, and then you just added him.
I mean, is it weird that I had Ben Simmons on the list? No.
Podcast. Suck up to Al podcast.
I was insulting him.
Oh, this is a joke. He
wasn't playing. Yeah, no, Ben Simmons was not on the list. I mean, he's obviously much too prominent.
No, Donovan Mitchell's not been playing.
No, Mitchell's been playing.
You felt like that was too much sucking up.
Yeah.
By me admitting that Donovan Mitchell
was
good.
This podcast has just, right. is going to be.
He may be Rookie of the Year, although Ben Simmons should be Rookie
of the
Year.
We'll find a way to get him back.
I'm sure you will. Had a very impressive play where I was complaining during the Husky game on Saturday about the notion of players following their own shots, and now it's almost always a terrible idea. It was not a terrible idea for Donovan Mitchell last night because I think he missed a jumper, and then kind of his momentum carried him into the lane, and then he just dunked home the miss. And that's a good way to do it. If you could do that every time, you should do it.
Didn't that happen in the game we were watching, too?
At one point, yes.
Yeah.
So Donovan Mitchell's awesome.
Yeah. And a big reason.
He's going to win the Rookie of the Year over Ben Simmons?
I think the momentum favors him right now. The Jazz have won 10 games in a row, and he tends to have like really big games, especially when they're like on national TV or more prominent games. So
that is kind of amazing. Yeah. We should talk about another rookie who's been in the spotlight lately. This is like the anti-Husky cast.
It is.
Bringing us back down to earth.
And that's Markelle Fultz, the number one overall pick, who has still not played since October due to the muscular imbalance in his shoulder.
What's the deal?
There's several different deals, isn't there?
There's a lot of deals. You can read various accounts of it. A nice piece by Kyle Newbeck in the Philly Voice today, kind of detailing what's gone on and talking to some people close to Fultz.
Did you understand what they were talking about the difference between the two different medical diagnoses he had gotten?
No, that's too subtle for me.
Okay. It's like a scapular imbalance versus I don't even know.
It's weird. There's no real precedent for it, whatever is going on right now. It's somewhat disconcerting in terms of Markelle Fultz's future value because he probably will need at some point to be able to make a shot outside the paint. So,
and he just can't right now.
Yeah.
That's what his GM says, right?
I mean, I think that's what watching video of him says as well.
It doesn't seem like they're even letting him take threes. If you watch the footage of him practicing his shots, he just does like pump fakes with the threes and he never shoots the ball, at least on camera for the press to see.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's stopping him. I mean, maybe in those circumstances, but if he was able to make threes successfully, I think they would definitely want the camera to see that. That would be the number one thing they'd want people to see.
You don't think Philadelphia is throwing Fultz under the bus, do you? Who do we blame here except for Markelle Fultz?
I don't think any of us know from the outside enough to blame anyone or anything
about what's going on. It's just a crazy situation.
And, you know, people, the question I get a lot is like, you know, you watched him so much at UW. Did you see this coming at all? No.
I think we maybe kind of did, didn't we?
There's a little bit.
Obviously
little
not
bit.
This, but no. Like, he kept being injured with like kind of strange injuries.
I wouldn't argue that. I would argue that his ascendance was so quick from being on a JV team to suddenly being the number one overall pick in the country that that's a little bit strange. And you might have less margin for error when your shot gets messed up to be able to know how to fix it because you haven't been playing at a high level for that long. That would be my argument.
Yeah, I mean, none of these guys have been playing at a high level for that long because they're in high school. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I in the realm of possible things I thought could happen for Markelle Fultz in his rookie season.
This is not one crazy. Of them. If you would have predicted this, that would have been pretty impressive.
I mean, it would have been bad if you would have predicted it because you would have predicted something else equally crazy that wouldn't have happened.
Where did your projections have Markelle Fultz?
Behind Lonzo Ball, but I felt he was comfortably the number two prospect in the draft.
Tried to get just one dig on Al or on Kevin.
That what?
That he thought he was going to be somewhat good.
Obviously, I thought he was going to be good.
That's all I have.
That's all you've got.
I've been reduced to that.
Markelle Fultz.
if we want to talk about bad takes by me, we can move on to the other weed up. It's part of our depressing Husky Guard tour of the NBA.
Okay, what is your bad take here? That you really like the Kyrie trade?
Yeah, I thought it was a great trade for Cleveland. That they got Isaiah Thomas and Jay Crowder, as well as the Brooklyn pick and Ante Zizic, who is often overlooked in these discussions. And then Isaiah turned
always
out
overlooked on Jesus and shit.
Isaiah turned out in Cleveland to be one of the 10 worst players in the league as he was coming back from his hip injury. But there's hope still. Hope springs eternal. He looked good in that Lakers game. I'm not gonna say that I'm expecting that from him because I don't want to get my hopes too high. But there's a path here.
This is especially painful for me because my cell phone case is that of a poorly photoshopped Isaiah Thomas in a Cavs jersey.
It's pretty well photoshopped, all things considered.
It's terrible. Just like everything that's been going on this week. But
well, that means you'll be able to photoshop him wearing a Lakers jersey.
Or whatever jersey he wears next.
Look, yeah, on, I know. Like, how long can I?
I'm telling you, you need to get an Isaiah jersey from every... You have to start getting these Isaiah jerseys right when he gets traded teams because you don't know how long he's going to be on them. And you want to have in a room just like a line of framed, like the 10, 15 different teams that Isaiah plays on, every single one of his jerseys.
That's not what I want for Isaiah. I want for Isaiah what he wanted for himself to be in Boston. That is, he wanted himself to be a hero. He wanted himself to be a fan favorite.
Have a home.
Yes, to have a home. And he doesn't have that anywhere. And it is very depressing.
What do you make, I guess, first, what do you make of this trade of kind of the whole Cavs situation in general? Have you talked about this on a podcast before?
Yes.
Okay. And then somebody should go listen to that. But then specifically to the whatever it is.
Locked on NBA.
Okay. With the Isaiah Thomas piece of it then, what do you make of that? Of the Cavs basically giving up on Isaiah after he played how many games? 15 games for them?
I think it was about 15. Yeah. I mean, the situation, like, obviously everyone feels bad for Isaiah because of the fact that they know that he had this very serious hip injury and that has caused him to be less effective upon his return. It was exacerbated by the fact that he continued to try to play as if he was a number one option in Cleveland, or at least a 1A behind LeBron James. And then his continued talking to the media about things that the Cavs as a team needed to do differently, which maybe wasn't the best place for him to say that at this point in how poorly he was playing. But here's the thing is, if he starts playing well, all of this goes away. So that's the piece. Like, if he starts playing like he played last year, then he can say whatever the hell he wants.
He's already in trouble with the Lakers.
Because of the not coming off the bench thing?
No, because he said, I felt really good. We had the first real practice I've had in a year.
Mm.
And that's apparently a shot at Cleveland.
Well, yeah, that's definitely a shot at Cleveland.
So then why is that?
Because that's apparently terrible. Like, LeBron can talk about all the flaws of the team. I understand he's the best player in the world, but if the Cavs don't practice full 5-on-5, Isaiah's just saying the truth.
Oh, Isaiah speaks the truth. Like, if you don't practice, it's crazy, right?
But there are sometimes you just don't need to say
that. I agree with that. Yes, yes, yes.
Isaiah needed to learn to keep his mouth shut for a little bit in Cleveland.
So the real loser of the trade sending Isaiah Thomas to the LA Lakers.
Who's that?
Is us.
It's me?
Those of us who had tickets.
It's Katie and her poorly photoshopped phone case.
No, I have another loss. Okay.
You do have another loss. Those of us who were going on Thursday to the UW game to see Isaiah Thomas's jersey retired, and specifically me, because I planned my trip to All-Star around this. And now all of a sudden, because of the fact that the Lakers have a game on Thursday where the Cavs did not, that ceremony has been postponed to Saturday night's game against Colorado as opposed to Thursday night's game against Utah.
I'm going to wear my Isaiah Thomas jersey and just stand near the top and hold it up. I'm going to manually hang it from the rafters. But no, this Cleveland trade is, to me, we talked about this immediately after, which was the best route. And look, Cleveland has played well in the one game or whatever, the two games that they've played since Isaiah's been gone. The best route that Cleveland had to winning a championship was Jay Crowder and Isaiah Thomas playing at the level that they played at last year.
Yeah, but I think we had passed a point of no return from a chemistry standpoint with Isaiah. All the reporting afterwards has made that pretty clear.
He was just so caught up with his leaving Boston. Like, that was the story, was Isaiah left Boston, and it kind of continued and continued, and he couldn't get out of that mindset. He couldn't leave Boston.
I don't know if that was necessarily the issue. I mean, I think that was perhaps an issue, but again, if he had played well, everything would have been fine.
Well, and part of it was that he maybe things would have been different if he's there not practicing from day one, just being there, playing from day one, though, playing those games and playing well. Maybe the story changes. But because he wasn't there, it kind of has exacerbated itself.
Yeah, I mean, he was hurt. It was a problem.
Is Luke Walton Brad Stevens' like coach who we think will be able to get the most out of Isaiah, though?
I mean, every coach is different. I don't know what a Brad Stevens type coach is. There's no one else that's really like Brad Stevens. Clearly from his first game, Isaiah is going to have the ability to have the ball in his hands a lot more with the Lakers than he did in Cleveland, and he feels much more comfortable in that role. So I think that's going to be a positive for him.
Okay.
Do we want to talk about the jersey retirement? In particular, one question that I think it was loyal listener Damon that raised, which is it insulting to Nate Robinson for the Huskies to retire the number 2 for Isaiah Thomas and not for Nate Robinson?
Kind of crazy, right? That they would have had two players wear the number 2 who are such notable players in the program.
And who are such similar players, you know, their stature and style of play.
Katie is so downtrodden over there.
Do we think that Nate Robinson merits jersey retirement?
I think he does, but does it mean that because we retire Isaiah's number that we can't retire Nate's?
It's a little weird to do it a second time. I mean, it's also weird to do it and have Dan Kingma wearing number 2, but, you know, there's a lot of...
Let's retire Kingma's number 2.
Dan Kingma can...
I just mean to continue wearing the number after it's retired.
Like, Katie can't handle this anymore. Isaiah, she's so distraught about that phone case.
She really is.
Does Nate Robinson merit it, though?
I think he does. Level below that.
Ugh.
I mean, who do you think is more deserving of it? Nate Robinson or Quincy Pondexter?
Both.
You can't require everyone's jersey. You don't want to be the Blazers.
Do they retire a lot of jerseys?
They retire a lot of jerseys. Too many jerseys.
I mean, those were the greatest heights that the program had seen in so many years.
Yeah.
Both of them. Nate Robinson probably deserves it more than Quincy Pondexter because he was the catalyst for the program being turned around.
He put us on the map again.
Turned it around.
That's possible. I mean, and Brandon Roy was there too.
He's already been retired.
Yeah, no, I mean, yes.
But I mean.
I would probably lean no on Nate. I'm sorry. It's nothing personal. I love Nate Robinson.
I knew there'd be some hate in this podcast.
There's a high standard to me for jersey retirement.
Well, I wanted to point out that I've been creeping on Instagram. And Nate Robinson seemed very happy for Isaiah Thomas getting his number retired.
If
so
he's happy, then we should
why
all be
do
happy.
We need to create controversy where there is none?
We can love both pho and ramen noodles. Just ramen
exactly.
is better. Ramen is Isaiah Thomas and pho is Nate Robinson. It's fine.
I think Nate Robinson's way better than pho.
You guys are the worst. collectively the worst.
The fabulous cousin Katie.
You thought these takes had been hot, but it's time to turn up the temperature.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at ya.
There's no greater sign that the Mariners hate the people and sports fans of Seattle than having a GM like Jerry DePoto, who is excited and willing to go out and make all of these trades. He loves trading. You had a take earlier this summer that maybe he was addicted to trading.
I don't know when that was in the summer. That was in December.
It was the summer for baseball. And he won't go out and trade for the one player that would truly matter to the Seattle Mariners.
Shohei Ohtani?
No. Shohei Ohtani rejected the Yankees. This player was willfully traded to the Yankees, and that's Russell Wilson. Come on, Jerry. The easiest thing you could do is trade for Russell Wilson. You don't have to do anything. It doesn't require prospects. What do they trade? Players to be named? Some small amount of money? You have the marketing would have loved that. If it was Russell Wilson is traded to the Mariners, it would have been amazing. But no, the Mariners do something wrong again, public relations-wise. First, they're anti-Sonics and Soto. Now they don't trade for Russell Wilson. What's next?
Not making the playoffs for 20 years.
That's my hot take.
Imagine going to Peoria if Russell Wilson were to play in spring training. And seeing Russell Wilson there, he would be the most exciting player at all of Mariners spring training.
It's sad but true.
Imagine having a baseball card like Michael Jordan shooting a jump shot on wearing his White Sox jersey. That would be Russell Wilson. They could have a picture of him throwing a football in a Seattle Mariners jersey. It would be amazing, and we would love every single second of it. And now we need to see Russell Wilson being a Yankee in pinstripes? This is your fault, Jerry! This is your fault!
The team that knocked the Mariners out of the playoffs the last two times they made it? I think two times.
First, Edgar isn't a Hall of Famer, and then the Mariners don't trade for Russell Wilson.
Nah, it sounds like it's been a long, cold winter for Mariners fans. I mean, the problem with this take is, of course, that Wilson clearly wanted to be traded to the Yankees.
Did the Mariners make an overture?
I don't know.
He celebrated by saying, "Hey, Pops, we made it." Like, it was like a thing, like a goal his father, who is deceased, had for him.
Wow. Wow. Bet you feel good about yourself now.
Winning the Super Bowl doesn't count as making it, huh? Okay. Wow. All right. I have more takes about Russell Wilson than in his priorities.
Pitchers and catchers report this week, I think. It seems like
who
about
cares?
The right time.
If Russell Wilson's not reporting, it doesn't matter.
All right. Should we do our little roundup here? We'll start with the Seattle Sounders, who played back-to-back scrimmages against California Union FC, a low-level side in Tucson, to finish their training there, winning 6-0 on Wednesday and 5-1 on Thursday before returning to Seattle for the next phase of their preseason. They will finish their preseason action with a friendly at USL side Sacramento Republic FC on Thursday. And one of the interesting things that's come out of the preseason for the Sounders and Brian Schmetzer is he's been experimenting with a 4-4-2 diamond midfield in the preseason. And so most notably, you know, they've historically played with kind of a 4-2-3-1 formation that only puts one player up top as a forward or a striker, either Jordan Morris or Will Bruin, and that player is kind of isolated on their own. This formation gives them a chance to play both Morris and Bruin together.
With Dempsey at the front of the diamond?
Yes, or to play Dempsey in one of those two striker roles opposite them to his kind of a strike partner. So offensively, it does seem to be yielding some good results so far. It is a bit of a less defensive formation, puts more pressure on, you know, whoever's in that defensive midfield spot in the diamond, whether that's Osvaldo Alonso or Christian Roldan, or Gustav Svensson, I guess, could also be there. And then, you know, the two wingers in that point take on more defensive responsibility than they maybe would otherwise. But that'll be interesting to watch. I don't think it'll be the primary formation for the Sounders, but something that they can go to over the course of this season. On the Seahawks front, the real news of the last week that Cam Chancellor's base salary is now guaranteed for 2018. His salary is already guaranteed for injury, so realistically, given, you know, the neck injury that he suffered that ended his 2017 season, he was going to get that money either way, but now it's officially official.
Okay.
Yep.
And no other news. I mean, almost maybe news that there's no other news.
Yeah, that they have not cut anyone at this point. We'll see what happens. All right, UW women's basketball lost 76-63 on Friday to number 9 Oregon and had a rougher go of against number 16 Oregon State on Sunday, losing 95-57 at home, dropping to 1-13 in conference play. This week they will travel to face Colorado and Utah. Colorado may be a chance to get a win. They're just 3-11 so far in the Pac-12. Utah 6-8. And then we'll wrap things up as far as the roundup with Husky football. Last Wednesday was, of course, signing day, as we previewed. The one outstanding recruit for the Huskies was Jeremiah Martin, a defensive end who picked Texas A&M over UW on signing day. So the final Husky class ended up ranked 13th by 24/7 Sports, 15th by ESPN. Then I thought...
And I saw there were some people online who are more excited about it than that, even, you know? There was an analyst who was talking about, like, kind of his four favorite classes that he saw, looking at the players maybe more individually as players rather than just kind of numbers and grades. And he had the Huskies, I think, as his number 3 or 4 class that he was looking at.
Wow.
Interesting.
I thought I saw something where we don't have any 5-star. Is that correct?
It depends on the different class. ESPN did not rate any of the players 5 stars. 24/7 did rate one player 5-star.
Brandon Cahill.
Yeah.
And USC is still getting the 5 stars, some. And so we still have some ground to make up, but it seems like we're trending in the right direction.
But if you look at the 2018 projections, very positive for UW relative to USC. Last weekend, Bill Connolly came out with his S&P projections for 2018 on SBNation.com. And the Huskies were ranked 4th in the country in those projections. Intriguingly, they were 2nd in terms of returning production among all teams in the nation, behind only Ohio State, because of the number of players coming back, the number of starters coming back. Auburn, whom the Huskies will face in the season opener in Atlanta, ranks 5th in those projections. USC tops the Pac-12 South at 15th. Stanford is 20th, and Oregon 23rd. So all of that, if that's an accurate gauge, which obviously much still to be determined, would set up pretty favorably for the Huskies in the Pac-12 at that point, especially because they host Stanford and do not face USC, at least would not be scheduled to during the regular season. So there you go. All right, let's wrap up with a rough weekend for UW men's basketball in the state of Oregon. On Thursday, could not get anything going offensively in a 65-40 loss to Oregon. Saturday night, a chance to get the split, led by double digits during the second half, but a furious comeback powered by a number of threes by Oregon State.
You had to point that out. And you smirked your way through it.
I did not smirk at any point. And the Beavers, with Stephen Thompson's pull-up three at the buzzer, the second time in 3 years, he handed the Huskies a loss at the buzzer in Corvallis.
It's almost like we've seen this before.
A 97-94 final. In a game that 2 years ago was probably the margin between, well, maybe not the whole margin, but definitely a huge hit to the Huskies' NCAA tournament hopes 2 years ago, and much the same this year.
What in the hell? I mean, that second half against Oregon State. Look, the loss to Oregon, we can just write it off at this point, right?
I don't know if we can totally write off scoring 40 points.
We're writing it off.
But that's not something we've seen a lot this year, and we haven't seen Jalen have a game like that.
At UCLA was pretty similar in the second half. That's probably, you know, 2 out of your 7 road games is probably 2 times too many to have complete offensive collapses.
I thought your thing last year was it's really difficult to play on the road in the Pac-12.
It is. And I mean, I think that's one of the lessons this week, is that, you know, the difference between the Huskies of last weekend beating Arizona and Arizona State at home and the Huskies who lost to Oregon and Oregon State, and particularly this close game against Oregon State, not that great. The home court advantage accounts for a lot of it. And so people were riding a little too high then. People are probably a little too low now on the Huskies.
But it was a game against Oregon State that they should have won.
Yes.
They weren't projected to win.
But just throughout the game, I mean, the lead that they had and some of the shots that Oregon hit to make that a close game, those shots shouldn't have gone in.
Well, that's all your fault, Tristan. No, it's your fault.
It's my fault?
Yes, because through, like, what time in the game, they were 1 for 8 or something. And then Tristan brought this up.
We just can't talk.
And then after that point, they went, what?
They didn't. They did not miss.
If I can't remember if they started 1 for 8, but they finished 9 of 19, which would be something like 8 of 11.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So,
it's like 3-point luck is like a perfect game. We just can't talk about it.
This is the game we've sort of been dreading. Now, I mean, I think the one thing I want to say here is the Huskies were not due for a game like this. That's the gambler's fallacy, that if you've been, you know, something hasn't been happening, then it's going to happen all the more. What Because a more accurate way to think about it is going forward, the Huskies' three-point percentage was more likely to be near league average than what they had been doing. Probably a little better than that, but near league average as compared to first in the conference by a wide margin. And what can happen is that, you know, given the variability in that from game to game, then you're going to see a night where the opponent makes 47% of their threes. But they weren't necessarily specifically due for this game. It did play out pretty much exactly how we feared, though, I would say.
Especially with a three at the end.
It finally happened.
We've been waiting for that three at the end the entire season. Yeah.
We're counting on it against Arizona State. We're counting on it against Arizona. Didn't happen in those games. Here it finally happened.
But even though I blame Tristan, really who I blame is myself. Because I came on this podcast and I made fun of Kevin and I joked about three-point percentage defense being real or not being real.
I hate this podcast. Suck up to you podcast.
Yeah. So right now I'd like to light a candle. You can edit that sound effect in. To Saint Sebastian, who is a patron saint of sports, and say, I am sorry for doubting your loyal servant, Kevin Pelton.
Oh, no. Oh, no. This went way too far. This went way too far.
The patron saint of three-point luck.
Yes. I am sorry to question you.
Ken Pomeroy is the patron saint of three-point luck, not me. One thing we did see in that game I thought that was interesting was when Oregon State started making threes, and in particular deep threes, it really stretched out the Husky zone. And all of a sudden, these wide gulfs are open in the middle of the zone for Trace Tinkle. Like before against Arizona, you know, you're getting DeAndre Ayton and Dusan Ristich to shoot the elbow jumper. And that's the kind of shot you'll live with all the time. In this case, Tinkle is catching the ball a step closer to the basket and then able to take a step towards the basket usually and then either, you know, finish over Sam Timmons or Noah Dickerson or, you know, draw that defensive attention and drop the ball off to Drew Eubanks or alley-oop it to him for a finish. And all of a sudden, Oregon State was basically unstoppable in the second half.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing I kind of worried about for the Huskies going into this latter half of the season is that people would be able to see what would work against the zone and plan for it better. And I think that the perfect player to plan for it was Tinkle, and he really took advantage. He didn't just shoot. Like, I think Ayton, like, did a lot of shooting in that place, but he passed it off a lot of the time. He dumped it off. He made the easy pass, and they got points nearly every time because of that.
Trace Tinkle finished two assists away from a triple-double in this game, had 29 points, 11 rebounds, and 8 assists.
God. But is the right thing to do here to just let them shoot long threes?
It might be. No, I think it definitely might
be. I mean, I'll be curious to see. We don't know if we'll see the situation again at all this year, but...
Right, you got to make those threes first to stretch out the Husky defense.
I'll be curious to see how Hopkins and the defense react if that happens again.
Yeah.
Because giving up these plays is not the right situation. Giving up what they gave up to Trace Tinkle. I would rather Oregon State, even if they're hot, be shooting long threes over and over and over again.
I mean, the other aspect is you probably change your defense a little bit when you are up by double digits in the second half because you're trying to protect that lead, take away the three. Okay, we'll live with the two. But they kept living with the two until the deficit became like a one-possession game. That's part of what happened here.
And Husky offense played pretty well in this one.
Yeah, they did.
I mean, they bounced back from that Oregon game, and they were able to score. They were able to withstand a lot of threes in the second half.
That's true. I mean, the one thing you point to is they had, again, in double overtime, but 19 turnovers in this game, 7 by Jalen Noel. That was the big disappointment. But they shot 56% on twos. Noah Dickerson, 8 of 12. Naz Carter, he's emerged as kind of like the one reliable player of the freshman group, the only one of those guys besides Noel to get off the bench on Saturday night, played 22 minutes and was very effective.
The rest didn't even make it off the bench.
Did not see Michael Carter, see Hamir Wright.
That's what the rotation should be from here on out.
Yeah, they struggled against Oregon.
I think Hamir brings some things.
I mean, it's tough because David Crisp in this game played 50 minutes.
Yeah.
Did not rest.
He's a college student. He doesn't need to rest. They only play Thursday and Saturday. Come on.
I mean, but by the time you get to the second overtime, I think the fatigue might be an issue at that point.
I think there was a time where in the game I was like so excited about Jalen being able to run on a fast break and sidestep the defender and not get a charge called against him. And then in the second half, kind of in crunch time when we really needed him to make that basket, he got the charge called against him and he just barreled into the defender. So it kind of shows what life is like for a freshman
By the way, I say that about David Crisp. Stephen Thompson, who made the game-winning three, played 49 minutes. It was that 1 minute of rest he got that really made the difference in double overtime.
My God. Well, so even after the two losses at the Oregon schools, Huskies still, by the various bracketologies, Joe Lunardi still has the Huskies as an 11 seed, which I think they were at before, right?
They were 10 seed last week. I was a little surprised by this because, you know, they were touting during the game that was on ESPNU that they had gotten the latest projection for Joe Lunardi before it, and the Huskies were, I think, last four in at that point. They lost the game and somehow still moved up to last four byes.
And then Jerry Palm was on with Softy today and claimed there was nothing the Huskies could do to guarantee themselves a spot in the tournament with the remaining games outside of winning the conference.
Yeah, that would be the thing you could do. I mean, I think if they win out in the Pac-12 play, they're going to be in pretty good shape at that point. But
they're in
a long ways to go there.
Didn't happen. 2012? What year was it?
Yeah. I mean, the conference isn't as bad as it was that year when the Huskies won the rate conference regular season and did not make it. Something that's unprecedented has never happened any other time in the history of the power conferences except that season. Great. Thanks, Pac-12.
But coming off of these two losses and still being, per bracketology, in the tournament is a good place to be in, all things considered.
Yeah, and we have how many games of at home versus, what, five?
Four of the final six are at home. I mean, the projections are no longer as favorable on Ken Pom. Has the Utah game is in a straight toss-up, 50-50. So on average, the Huskies go 3-3 over these last six games and would finish 10-8 in conference. I think, you know, to really feel good about their NCAA tournament chances, they probably need to go 4-2, get to 11-7, and then you've got a pretty good chance of being one of the top four seeds in the Pac-10 Pac-12 tournament and getting a bye to the quarterfinals.
And that's not undoable, right? Because they could win all their home games and then they could beat Cal, right?
And that, I mean, that would be 5-1 if they won all their home games and beat Cal.
Oh, that would be 5-1. Okay.
Yeah, and at that point, you'd go 12-6 in conference. So that'd be really good.
Let's start with Utah. So tell us about Utah.
Yeah, so Utah, a team that kind of kept the Huskies at bay in the matchup down in Salt Lake City earlier this year in an 8-point victory. They have moved back up into fifth in the conference in the KenPom rankings, although they're part of a four-way tie for sixth in the actual standings. They walloped the Bay Area schools by a combined 49 points last weekend at home. Their offense really relies on ball movement. They're 12th in the NCAA in assists per field goal per field goal, and then also spacing. They attempt the 28th most three-pointers as a shot, a percentage of field goals in the country. So that's something that obviously contrasts with the Huskies' strength in terms of taking away the three. They did not have a lot of success from downtown in the first matchup, shooting 7 of 27 on threes, but made up for that by getting to the free throw line 30 times, and the Huskies shot 2 of 18 themselves behind the arc. So that was another one of those kind of games where on the road their offense struggled to get going. Utah, not a team that really uses the offensive glass or is very good rebounding at either end of the floor typically, but they had a great offensive rebounding game against the Huskies, and their 5'8" point guard Justin Bibbins was a big factor on the glass. He had 10 rebounds in a 2010 game with 5 assists in this one, so watch out for him. Moving ahead to Colorado on Saturday, they lost three in a row, starting with UW going into Boulder and winning, but now has won the last three games, although they kind of got a scare from lowly Cal, the worst team perhaps in the Pac-12, winning 68-64 at home last Wednesday before beating Stanford later in the weekend. They're 7-6 in Pac-12 play, but getting outscored by 2.7 points per 100 possessions, so they've been a little fortunate in terms of their close games. They're allowing the lowest two-point percentage in the conference, despite almost never blocking any shots, which is a really interesting thing. They often play lineups with 6'7" Tyler Bay and 6'6" George King as their front court. So you wouldn't think of this as a team that's good at defending the two. You'd think of, you know, a team like Arizona with DeAndre Ayton, but instead it's Colorado that's number one so far in Pac-12 play. They also almost never force any turnovers, but rarely turn the ball over themselves. George King, I think, is again the player to watch in this matchup. We highlighted him last time, and the Husky Zone did a great job on him in Boulder. He scored 13 points on 5 of 13 shooting as the Huskies came up with the upset win that time.
Percentage chances of victory. One, I guess let's do each of the games and then kind of overall for the weekend.
I would say about, you know, 40, I would say a little less than 50-50 against Utah. I don't think they're a good matchup for the Huskies. I would say maybe like 45% there, but like 70% against Colorado, who I think the Huskies do have kind of a pretty good beat on.
Okay. So then what about overall for the weekend? Chances of winning both?
So that'd be a little bit better than 1-4 chances of winning both. A little worse than 1-5 chances of getting swept, and the most likely scenario being a split this weekend.
If they split, what do the Huskies look like after that?
So they'd be 8-6 in conference play and then favored in 3 of their 4 remaining games. So, again, it's not a terrible situation.
Okay, it's not the end of the world if they split.
But at that point, I think they probably would be out of the NCAA tournament projections. So,
okay.
Well, we're going to be at the Utah game, right?
Yes.
So we'll be there to cheer them on.
I mean, I think that's – we'll see if the crowd still turns out. I think
it's important.
Were they nearing a sellout or heard that, had they actually sold out?
I don't know if they sold that out.
I mean, it's a 6 p.m. game on a Thursday, which is a bit of a tough swing for the city of Seattle. But this is a game, I think, where the crowd could make a difference.
Because I think the crowd really did make a difference in the Oregon game. I think they really got in Jalen Noel's head. And so I think it would be nice for him to get that confidence. And, you know, he had that in the Oregon State game, but I think it would be nice for him to have that again at home.
These would be good crowds for both, though.
I think definitely the Colorado crowd should be great. Especially
apparently
now
they still have tickets remaining to the Colorado game.
Yeah,
so
I think those will probably get snapped up.
To the listener, buy that ticket.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're on the fence, listener, go to the game.
Or come say hi if you see us there. We'll be the one with the group of people with the small child. With Luke. And if you want to prepare your most obscure colleges to quiz him about, or if you know the names of Power Moons and Super Mario Odyssey.
Oh, that's a good one.
He'll be happy to discuss either with you.
We'll also potentially be at the Beecher's Mac and Cheese station getting some of that.
Definitely will be there.
It's a station?
Yeah, it's kind of like a cart.
Okay.
Yeah. I can point you in the right direction.
We'll give you a full breakdown.
All right. Well, on that note, thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Thank you.